The middle of a scorcher of a week and plenty on the radio. This is Playback Daily. I'm Carol Melty Moran, and here's what you might have missed.
I got, through the course, I got apology letters. One of them went into 4 pages. Yes, I got apology letters. So this is what I can't understand, how somebody was trying to ruin me online, but once they were found out and once we had got a name, that they would write me a 3-page apology letter.
O'Malley was a change maker, literally of a generation.
It's not even about what they took. I think they just took some Nike runners, actually. It's not like we had anything at that age. At 21, didn't have any money. But it's just that someone was in your space. It's not nice.
And we'll start here on the live line in the afternoon. So have you ever had a break-in at your house? It's a horrible experience. And on the live line, people were sharing their stories of break-ins, starting with Lisa Ann telling Joe about the impact of a burglary at her home.
We've been talking, as you know, over the last 4 days, indeed, Graham Taylor, Dean McGuire, Carl Freeman, those three young men who should still be alive. They got involved in crime. Over 200 convictions between them. They were killed in a car crash when they drove down the wrong way down a motorway and head on into a truck. But a lot of their convictions were for burglary, and we've been talking about burglary and then the glorification of their careers, including a screwdriver and a torch on the altar during their funerals. What happened to you last December, Linda Ann?
Yeah, we had been out for the day shopping. The first time we'd been out because we'd been in lockdown for so long.
Of course, yeah.
We had some Christmas shopping to do, so we left in the morning, came back home about 6 o'clock in the evening, and the first thing I noticed was that the window in the front room was open. And I knew immediately we'd been broken into. And we would never have left that open. So, yeah, I ran in headlong into the house, which was probably the wrong thing to do, and straight up the stairs. Found my bedroom completely ransacked, everything pulled out, and then, of course, I knew that everything precious to me was gone, everything, you know, precious in a monetary sense, I suppose. I suppose what I hadn't reckoned on was the other things that they would take from me, and that's that feeling of being your home being violated, the vulnerability that you feel after something like that, when you feel that your home is a safe place to be. You know, that thing of now every time we go out, we're double-checking doors are locked, making sure everything is secure, and then trying to get back as quickly as possible because it's changed everything, really, for us. So, yeah.
They got items of extraordinarily sentimental value.
Absolutely, absolutely, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I suppose every piece of jewellery, and, you know, it was when I started to do the list for the police of actually what was gone, I realised that there's jewellery in there, from my confirmation. You know, I'm 65 now, so there was a lifetime of bits of pieces of sentimental jewellery. But the most sentimental pieces were pieces that my late husband gave me when my two girls were born, and they were meant to be passed down to them. Obviously, I have nothing now. I mean, I was left, obviously, with the jewellery I was wearing, which was precious little because of COVID and hand washing and whatever. I was wearing very little jewellery. So it all went, every piece of it. And that, you know, while it might sound frivolous, it's actually, there's a real grieving process in that as you think of the memories that are attached to pieces of jewellery and things that you can't replace because the person who gave them to you is gone.
Because your husband was killed in June 1990, which is 31 years ago from what you tell me. He was in his early 30s.
He was 30, yeah. Yeah, and my girls were 3 and 5 at the time. So these are really, you know, they were precious pieces of jewellery that we were holding on to. That would be that kind of perpetual memory of their dad and then grandfather and for their children, whatever.
And can I ask what happened to your husband, Linda?
He was actually coming to collect me. He and a colleague were coming to collect me and some of my lady friends at the Wild Coast. And they had driven past a roadblock that was actually stopping petrol, stopping cars going back toward Durban.
Okay, South Africa, yeah.
And they drove past. They weren't stopping people going into Wildcliffe, that area.
Mm-hmm.
But they came across somebody who was stuck at the side of the road, and they stopped to give them a hand, and this person needed petrol. And they realised that the nearest petrol station was back toward Durban, so they set off back that way, and then came across a tailback of cars because of the roadblock. So they decided, well, that wasn't going to work. So they turned to go back toward the Wild Coast. And as they were driving away, two soldiers who were a stopper group, one of them fired a shot at the car, and it went through the tail light and through the two seats and through my husband, who was a passenger. Yeah. So it was just, yeah, I mean, even as I recount it, I mean, they were just such traumatic days.
That's unbelievable.
And we had many traumatic years in South Africa after that, as we went through inquests and court cases and so on. So when we came home here to Dublin in 1995, we came home to a place that was of safety and security and freedom for the girls, you know, because obviously life out there is very different. So, yeah.
Well, that's Lisa Anne on the live line, and we'll come back to some of these burglary stories later in the programme. And on Morning Ireland, how to be cool in the hot, hot weather. Here's Una Kelly's report.
It's too darn hot. It's too darn hot.
It's interesting, I've looked around and I see men in short trousers who would never wear short trousers, rolling up their sleeves of shirts. I'm an example myself, but this is something I've said many times. Nobody has really designed a dress for the Irish climate. We could have four different seasons in the one day, and you'd have to have some sort of a layered clothing that you could take on and off very easily.
That's the thoughts of one fashion watcher in Dublin city centre. Dressing for the heat can be tricky when it takes you by surprise. And sometimes we all need some advice.
They're useful. This is another pair of shorts, but these are sort of beach shorts, the cool...
I'm Deirdre McQuillan, the fashion editor of the Irish Times. I do see people wearing very, very... men particularly wearing very, very tight shirts where the buttons are beginning to stretch a bit, and I think that's not a good look. They need to kind of wear something a bit looser and more comfortable. So I think top tips are good footwear. You don't want sweaty toes, and I think you need to have a good pedicure because you're going to be looking at your toes a lot, your bare toes, a good hat and good shades, and the rest is easy enough.
In terms of cut of clothes and fabrics, what would you recommend?
Well, I'm totally against any kind of synthetic fabric. Polyester, no, it'll only make you sweat and feel uncomfortable. Cotton, linen, silk are all good, but it's comfort really that you're after, and coolness. Comfort and coolness, loose clothing, comfortable clothing. You can get really inexpensive organic cotton in pennies, so you don't need to spend a lot if you want to get a pair of shorts. I do my favourite tip about shorts is get them with wider legs rather than clinging to your thighs. So they look better that way, I think.
Some skirts, the big seller now would be the denim skirts, because for all the young kids.
Teresa works in Liberty Recycling charity shop on Camden Street. She says people tend to search shops like hers for summer bargains.
We're getting a lot of men now, a lot of men coming in for shorts and t-shirts, and ladies coming in for the hot pants and the mini skirts and summer trousers and dresses.
Were you able to meet that demand? Did you have enough for people?
Yeah, no, we're able to meet the demand. Yeah, well, as you can see, we're running out of men's shorts.
Do you think that Irish people know how to dress well for the heat?
Not at all. Look at me, I'm sweating.
What do you see people wearing?
A lot of the young people are wearing shorts and mini skirts and that now at the moment, and a lot of women are wearing the long dresses. Yeah, well, Irish women are stylish, aren't we?
Back in Dublin city centre, not everyone is impressed with the summer style on display.
Now the young lads dress in tracksuits, literally, and then when it's winter they're in the sandals and the flip-flops and the shorts and the tank tops, but when it's summer they don't dress like it's summer. They're literally dressing like it's winter.
I mean, in Latvia, like, I feel like people are a little bit more mannerly. You won't see like people in town shirtless or something, because I feel like that's a little inappropriate. Not inappropriate, but like in Latvia we think that's inappropriate. So people would usually take off tops, like, you know, at the beach. But here you can see like people around towns walking shirtless. I don't mind, but you know, some people have a problem with that and I feel like they should keep their shirt on.
I think actually it comes as such a surprise actually for the weather that I think scantily dressed, I would believe that, you know, for the days that are actually hot, I think Irish people just underdress in the hot weather.
A lot of people were running around in their swimmers and that kind of stuff, like when they weren't swimming.
A lot of middle-aged men not wearing shirts. That's been pretty bad. Or the guys still going around in jeans because they don't have shorts, or like still in the trackies and the jeans, but they're melting. Yeah, that's not good.
For Morning Ireland, and then later Oliver Callan was also talking about staying cool.
And yes, Met Aaron has officially declared a heat wave as of yesterday afternoon, because we've now had 5 consecutive days where the weather stations have clocked 25 degrees or more. So I hope you're having a lovely time if you're on your holidays. And I know some people who were over in Achill Island in Mayo with their kids. It looks like the Caribbean there from the pictures I've seen. And I believe the summer was poor in Mayo up to now. So they'll be glad of that for the moment. And stay cool wherever you're working. I've been indoors in front of a computer now from most of this week so far. And I've forgotten at times that the weather is so hot. And then you go out and go, oh my God, this is amazing. We're like, I'm too tired to enjoy it. I'm tired now after 30 seconds. I can't do it. Get in touch, by the way. The text is 51551. The email is ryan@rte.ie. And I've been reading about tips to stay cool at night, because that is the topic of conversation. How did you sleep? Can you sleep? Yeah, but it's very hot. Have you got a duvet? How many tog? Is it 4.5 tog? 4.5 tog is too heavy, even for this weather. Is there anything less? I don't think there is. It's a sheet, which apparently everyone becomes an expert then. Oh, no, the sheet is no good. It has to be made of cotton because that's the most breathable one. But anyway, the top tips on how to get sleep when it's hot. Put your bedding in the freezer for a couple of minutes. That's in a plastic bag. You have to put it in first, then put it into the freezer. So you'd need a chest freezer, wouldn't you? Or you could fold it, unless it's small enough to fold in. And that'll keep you, or your pillowcase as well, or your pyjamas, bag them up, put them in the freezer for a while. And that'll keep you cool for about 20 seconds. Is that how long it would take for your body to heat it up? Now, this one is to repurpose a winter staple. The hot water bottle. Yeah, hot water bottle. My granny used to call it the hot water jar. It becomes a cold water bottle if you fill it with iced water. And you put on the cooling points of your body, which are knees, ankles, wrists, neck, groin and elbows. I've also seen ones where people put the cold water bottle, just fill it with cold water, put it in the freezer for a small time, not long enough to freeze. And then you stick it under your sheets and you cool your sheets. And that's another effort. Is any of this going to work? Moisturise before bed, of course, with an aloe vera based after sun cream. Put it in the fridge. But you do that anyway, don't you? And you're fearing you keep your skin nice and cool. You put your after sun and your moisturiser in the fridge and you get a nice chill from that. Fill an empty perfume bottle with chilled water. Keep it beside your bed so you're spraying it on your face. God, you'd really have to clean the perfume out, wouldn't you, if you're going to spray it onto your face. We avoid the eyes, I suppose, back of the neck and so on. This one now, I didn't think was going to be, this didn't make sense to me initially, but it does have scientific evidence behind it. Eat spicy food before bed, at least 3 hours before bed, because it makes you sweat. Because everyone complains about the sweat, but the sweat is your body trying to cool it down. But the important thing here, apparently, is that the spicy food will raise your body temperature to the same temperature as it is outside. Oh God, when I say that, it doesn't sound like... How to keep cool is to raise your body temperature. Anyway, so you'd have to get the spice right if you're into it. Match the temperature outside, basically, so there's kind of equilibrium there. And then the sweat will do the rest and it'll keep you nice and cool. And I heard someone else saying, you know, the people are having the freezing showers. No, tepid is the best way to go, because a freezing cold one, your body will react to a sudden change in temperature and it'll start preserving the heat, going, oh my God, everything is cold outside, so I've got to keep warm. So tepid is the best, they finally the thing. Turn off all electrical devices in your bedroom, as these emit heat. Yes, and the lights apparently, but obviously not so many that you're going to go around stubbing your toe. Switch off the electrical sockets. That's a bit far. Well, they've gone a bit far there now. I thought this is going to, if you've got a fan in the room, put a roasting pan full of ice in front of the fan, because it's going to push all the cool air around the room. It's very clever. Sleep in a separate bed from your partner, because two bodies is twice the body heat. But if you don't live in a manor in the Cotswolds in Western England, then that's not going to work for you. Sleep downstairs if you can, as the heat obviously rises. And sleep wet your socks. Go to bed in wet socks. They're losing the run of it here. and or even a damp T-shirt. So you can have your own wet T-shirt competition at home. In you go into bed. You also can damp your hair and wash your feet in cold water. That's you'd be changing the mattress, but you might stay very cool. And if you wake up in the middle of the night, rub a menthol stick on your forehead. I don't know what that is. Is that like chewing gum? You kind of like Wrigley's, start rubbing yourself with Wrigley's spearmint gum in the middle of the night. Don't know.
That's Oliver Callan in the morning. And just as the Today programme started, the announcement was made of the death of the former minister and founder of the Progressive Democrats, Des O'Malley. Claire Byrne was talking to political correspondent Micheál Lehane.
So this news just announced in the last few moments, the death, as I say, of Desmond O'Malley.
Yeah, news just announced that Desi O'Malley has passed away, one of the most prominent politicians of the last number of decades. And of course, former minister, but even perhaps more significantly than the founder of the Progressive Democrats, and notable along the way that despite that acrimonious split from Des O'Malley, from Fianna Fáil, that he would ultimately form a historic coalition with that party, which was viewed as unlikely but highly significant when it did happen.
Okay, and as you say, he played an extraordinary role in Irish politics in the 1990s and before that when he was minister in Charlie Haughey's government.
Yeah, I mean, he was the former justice minister as well, and that a very notable period in Irish history, and then a notable period too, particularly because of the arms trial and the arms crisis. And then a Fianna Fáil minister that would find himself at odds with the rising figure within that party, Charlie Haughey, in the early 80s, that ultimately Des O'Malley would leave Fianna Fáil following a Dáil vote at a point in the mid-80s.
Yeah, and it was an extraordinary feat in the 1987 election when the Progressive Democrats won 14 seats. I mean, when we think about it in the context of now, creating a new party and the might of Fianna Fáil at that time to achieve that election result in 1987 was no small achievement.
Yeah, 14 seats and the unlikely coalition then that would follow 2 years later. The PDs, of course, it was never the closest relationship, that coalition, and they would pull out of that government in 1993, then Desi O'Malley retiring as party leader and retiring from public life in 2002. But I suppose what that coalition showed is that the days of single-party government were drawing to a close, and that unlikely and unexpected political alliances had to be formed to make governments work. That was the first real modern example of that. There had been the inter-party government of 48, but in modern times, that was the big breakthrough moment in that regard. And he was instrumental in that.
Okay, Micheál, thank you very much. We're going to return to this later on in the programme, but for now I want to go to Gerard Howlin, who former advisor to Fianna Fáil Party and also a columnist with the Sunday Times. Gerard, good morning to you. Thank you for joining us.
Good morning.
I know you're just hearing this news, but if you can assess Desi O'Malley's role, influence and legacy when it comes to Irish politics.
Well, he was a hero to me. As a young student, I was a founding member of the Progressive Democrats. I didn't have any significance in the foundation of the party. But O'Malley, to me, was a hero. He completely changed the context of Irish politics. We talk now about a 90-year-old political order ending in 2011, and it did. But a generation before, he completely changed the context of Irish politics. And after the foundation of the Progressive Democrats, nothing was ever the same again. And everything that came since can be traced back to that moment when he fundamentally fractured an old order. And he was a man, he was very reluctant, I think, to go down the road of founding the Progressive Democrats. I understand a lot of persuasion had to be made on him to do so. But when he did, he acted decisively. He was an extraordinarily brave, consequential man.
Can you give us a sense of the atmosphere at that time when he eventually took that decision to lead the Progressive Democrats Party? And, you know, again, going back to the strength, the power of Fianna Fáil at that time, we can only imagine the courage that it took to do what he did.
Yes, and the context, of course, was that he, O'Malley, having refused to vote for, to vote against Barry Desmond's bill to liberalise the contraceptive regime and that famous great I Stand By the Republic speech, he was expelled by the National Executive of Fianna Fáil for, quote, conduct unbecoming the party, unquote. And in the wilderness, it seemed that he would remain perhaps as a TD in Limerick, but no more, that he was now, if you like, cornered and squared off. But when he stepped back on the pitch, he did something that only people had failed to do before, which was to set up a party that would have another party that would have long-term consequences. Clown the Public and so on in the past had never really achieved that. But the Progressive Democrats did more than any other party thereafter. And the atmosphere in 1986, people forget the monster meetings. He was like a messiah. I was a student in Trinity at the time, and a couple of us organised a Progressive Democrat meeting. And the scale of it was such that the security in Trinity became very alarmed. He and Mary Harney had to be escorted into the building through the Provost Garden, because the corridors were so crowded, there was no way through. The place erupted when they arrived. And similarly in Galway, similarly out in Malahide, similarly in Cork, and people flocked to him. There was a moment when people really wanted change and something erupted. Mm-hmm. And he was literally had a messiah status.
So for you, somebody who saw Desi O'Malley as a hero, when he then led the PDs into a coalition government with the Haughey-led Fianna Fáil Party in 1989, what was your own feeling about that move?
It was partially, I think, concern and partially, I think, admiration, because that was the moment we can now see in hindsight that he fundamentally fractured the political order that had existed from the foundation of the state. It was the beginning of the end, as we can see in hindsight, for Charles Haughey, and that long, long battle over 20 years was one that O'Malley fundamentally, completely won. And in going into government, in changing the political context, in bending Haughey to his will, and I think that is, in hindsight, what we can see happened. O'Malley was the change maker, literally, of a generation.
Gerard Howland talking to Claire Byrne in the morning. Then later on the news at 1, Brian Dobson spoke to Des O'Malley's friend and former party colleague, Mary Harney.
Mary Harney, you're welcome to the programme on this very sad day. Our thoughts clearly are very much with the O'Malley family, but also with you, his many political, former political allies and friends. He'd perhaps not been so well in recent times, but I think his death has come as a real shock.
Thank you, Brian. It certainly has. It's very hard for me to get my head around the fact that Des O'Malley has gone. He's been a friend of mine for 40 years, my political mentor. And even a few weeks ago, 2 weeks ago today, in fact, 2 weeks tomorrow, he came out to vote in the South Dublin Bay South by-election from the nursing home, even though he was very unwell. He was, by any standards, an extraordinary person. And I'm really going to miss him, as so many other people are. But my thoughts today are obviously immediately with his family, his 6 children, his 13 grandchildren. Des, first of all, was a family man. He had a wonderful marriage to Pat, who passed away 4.5 years ago. They were married for almost 50 years. Theirs was, as he described in his eulogy, a real marriage. And he was very proud of his 6 children. He spoke frequently about them. Myself, I knew them long before I ever met them. And in more recent years, his 13 grandchildren brought him great joy. And it's, you know, when I saw him yesterday, he was clearly suffering. And as a friend, it's good to see that the pain and suffering is over. But certainly, we will all miss him. And Ireland is a better place because of Des O'Malley. He was a man I've listened to the tributes today. The words being used are courage, principle, integrity. And they're all so, so true. He was an outstanding public servant in the best sense of that word. And it's, you know, it's hard to believe that at the age of 30 he was government chief whip, which would have been very difficult in those years. And at 31 he was Minister for Justice. And as people have heard, he had to sleep with a gun under his pillow. He couldn't stay in the same house in Dublin for more than 1 week at a time. His wife and children were often taken in the middle of the night out of their home because they were in a dangerous situation. His in-laws in Oma, Pat, his wife, was from Oma. Her family business was blown up by the IRA. And he was completely opposed to the IRA campaign of violence in the north. He was convinced that peaceful engagement with all sides was the only way to secure solutions to the political and social problems. And he reminded us all frequently of the fragility of democracy and the dangers to the state posed by the ongoing violence. Des always drew a very clear distinction between a modern republic and the ever-present threat of militant republicanism. He was a genuine republican, and he was a man of unwavering principle, willing to speak out and act in the interests of peace and democracy. But I think I'm not going to do it the injustice of trying to sum up his life, but except to say he had a very sharp intellect. He was a ferocious opponent, but a powerful ally. He had a great sense of humour, absolutely great sense of humour, and that remained right up to the last. I saw him yesterday. He was obviously not able to talk when I saw him yesterday, but on Sunday morning I had a long conversation with him, and it was full of humour, even though it was clear that he hadn't long left in this world. And he kept that remarkable sense of perspective right to the very end. Nobody would ever intimidate him. If you were a civil servant coming to present to him, you had to make sure that you knew all your facts. He was very thorough, very, very thorough indeed. And on Sunday, one of the things he said to me was that he really regretted the fact that Anne McCabe sent him an invitation to the late Gerry McCabe's commemoration 25 years after his death, which was held in Adair a few weeks ago. And he said, "I was really, really sorry I wasn't able to go." Mm. But I was able to send her a message to tell her I was in a nursing home, and because he spoke frequently about the great injustice that was done to Gerry McCabe and Ben O'Sullivan. They were people that he knew well. They were part of a security team in Limerick. And he took Gerry's death and Ben O'Sullivan's serious injuries really, really seriously. He really felt for them as if they were an extended member of his family. And he spoke frequently about the courage and bravery of Anne McCabe, even last Sunday morning.
You've mentioned Mary Harney, his own courage in facing the threats, particularly at the early stage of his career that he faced, the principal stand he took at various stages. Another word that's been used to characterise his contribution to Irish politics today is consequential. He is a politician who changed our politics in ways that we're still living with today. For example, clearly with the formation of the Progressive Democrats, but also then by leading that party back into coalition government with his great rival, Charlie Haughey and Fianna Fáil.
Yes, I think it's fair to say he did break the mould, and that coalition ended, perhaps began the end of civil war politics. I heard the columnist Gerry Howland this morning speak about he fractured an old order. I thought that was a really excellent way of putting it. He reformed industrial policy in Ireland. He established the Culleton Commission to look at how we would reform Irish industrial policy to make it fit for purpose and to make sure that we could grow and be a successful economy. He brought in the first Competition Act in Ireland. It was the whole issue around the Beef Tribunal. Mm-hmm. When he became minister, he noted that Ireland was indebted to the extent that we were had export credit insurance for more beef than the country was producing, and therefore we were probably covering other countries' beef, and he cancelled that to save the taxpayer at least 100 million at the time. So in every sense, he stood by the Republic, whether it was standing by the taxpayer, whether it was reforming our company law, whether it was making our economy mm-hmm. fit for purpose to grow employment and jobs.
That's Mary Harney from the News at One with Brian Dobson. And in the morning, Oliver Callan was talking about online trolling and abuse. Lisa McGowan took a stand on the issue after being on the receiving end of accusations and sinister messages on her social media platforms. She was telling Oliver a bit about her life.
Okay, so lots of people will know me as Lisa McGowan.
Yes.
So I'm an insurance broker by profession and I'm working here in the family business. I'm taking the call in the office actually before we open up.
Right.
And I think I'm here about 30 years. He's only fired me 3 times in that 30 years.
Who's the he?
So that's what I do. That is my profession. But I also have grown a business online, and I have 300,000, more than 300,000 collectively following me now on my social media channels. Yeah, it's a bit crazy. So I've two jobs. Well, like 3 jobs because I'm a mammy to Dara as well. That's probably the most important job.
You're enormously busy. And when you're referring to the he's only fired me, that's your dad, isn't it?
That's my dad.
He's
the main man.
McGowan's
the main
insurance.
Man. The rock of the family.
Okay,
yeah.
Well,
yeah.
You know, you're there 30 years. I think you're hardly a blow in on the family business. And this is all in Tullamore and Offaly, isn't it?
That's right. Down in the Midlands.
Great. And you'd never think of that would be the centre of a place to build an online, essentially global empire, isn't it, online?
Well, I wouldn't go as far as say global empire, but I do have followers in America and followers in Scotland and Australia. And yeah, it's growing. It is growing and growing very fast, thankfully. I'm very, very lucky.
So
yeah, I have a lovely, I have to say 99.9% of my followers are just fabulous.
Okay, you will say that, won't you? But obviously the feeling is mutual there. So it's all about fashion, isn't it? It's called Lisa's Lust List. What does that do online exactly?
Okay, Lisa's Lust List, just getting back to Lisa's Lust List, I know when I started the page and initially I had picked the name, my mum had said to me, Lisa, I don't know about that name. That sounds like a dodgy name. I said, Mom, it rhymes and it's good. I said, Lisa, you're going to have men following you. That's not the type of account you should be having. I said, Mom, you don't understand. My mom is 80. She didn't get it. She gets it now.
Yeah.
Lots of people can't pronounce it and they call me Lushy Lisa. So it's good fun. It's good fun.
Yeah.
But no, it's an online platform and I would give my recommendations on fashion and beauty. And from there then, it stemmed on. I have my own website and I have a monthly newsletter going out once a month to over 30,000 people. It's growing. I have my own fashion line now. I launched my fragrances last year. Pajamas were launched in the last month. There's t-shirts and dresses coming. It's all, thank God, it's all going really, really well for me. But I couldn't do it without the followers. I couldn't do it without my followers.
I also love that you got the idea really from the most Irish way possible, because although it sounds technical and very kind of out there, it comes from the Galway races.
That's right, 2000 and, oh God, did I get this right, 2016, I think I won the Galway races. I got a little
best
bit of online
lady.
Abuse then, but
that
was to be expected. I didn't, it was like, you're out there, you know, you're going to hit the news, you're going to hit the papers, you will get online, not so nice comments. So I got a little taster of it back in 2016.
Did you, when you won Best Dressed Lady, Begrudgers were out. So, I mean, how do you get through all of the work? Because you're still in the insurance broker industry and this, like everyone who tells us they do stuff online consumes an enormous amount of time. And as you say, your most important job is being mum to Dara. So how do you get through it all?
I don't sleep very much. And anybody that follows me will know that I don't sleep. But that's, if you want to do something and you love to do something, you'll do it. It's as simple as that. And I love what I do. I love what I do. I really, really do. Yeah.
No, it sounds
you'll make
like
it work. You'll make it work.
When you're under the pressure that you want to do, it'll happen.
Yeah.
I was hoping for some kind of magical thing but that's just not sleeping. What is your working day like? Because as you say, you were talking to me, but just before that you were in the insurance business. Now you probably have to go do stuff online. So what is your average day like?
Okay, so this morning I was up at 6. I did a spin class at 7, an online spin class at 7, because I have to get my exercise in from my headspace. That's me away from the phone for that hour. Then doggy, baby number 2 in the house, gets his walk, and then into work. I do a bit of online before I go into work, finish at 1, come home between 1 and 3, do another bit of online work, working with the brands, collaborations, back into the office again, home at 5, get a bit of dinner, back online. Yeah. But when I say work, it's not work to me, because I enjoy it.
And Lisa spoke about the issues she's had with online abuse.
300,000 or whatever followers I have combined on Facebook and Instagram, 99.9% of them, they are fabulous, fabulous women. They're fun, they're funny, they're kind, they're smart, they message me every day. I have a relationship with so many of them. It's just a tiny percentage that caused me the hassle. And they're not even followers, you know. They haven't hit the follow button. But it's like they developed some sort of a weird obsession with me. They have the fake names, the fake profiles. You know, they don't follow me, but every morning they will get up on their phone or on their computer and they'll type in my name and they will watch me and re-watch my stories and try and find fault in something that I would post or speak about on that day. But they get up every morning and type my name into their computer and look for me, you know, to say something negative about me. I don't understand the mentality of it. You know, if you don't like somebody, like if you don't like watching the television, I know Mark Rogers, a good friend of mine, say, I don't like EastEnders, I don't watch it. You know, if you don't like somebody, if you find them irritating, and I'm sure somebody, I mean, I'm not going to be everybody's cup of tea. I know that I'm not going to be everybody's cup of tea. But if you don't like somebody or if somebody winds you up, don't watch it. These individuals, small, very, very small individuals, probably with multiple accounts, would actually type my name in every morning
and
literally
time.
Stalk me. It was like an obsession. Yeah. I now, because I'm over the back of it, I call them my super fans because you can't block them because they're not following you anyway, but they'll watch and rewatch and watch and rewatch. I don't know. I just don't get it. I'll never get it. I've tried to understand it.
They start leaving messages. Is that how it kind of
operated? That's right, yeah. Like, I know it's part of my job with a large following to get a certain amount of negative comments. You know, some of them are extremely personal. Some of them are very unkind. But you get on with it because that's part and parcel of what I do. You know, but there was a line crossed, you know. I do fashion shows around the country. I don't know if you're aware of that. I do Lisa Lustless shows around the country, and I meet people who follow me, and part of that would be to raise money for local charities.
Yes.
And I'm proud to have helped raise 100,000, you know, last year. Not last year, obviously, with lockdown, there was no shows. Please God, we'll have them again. But the last year that we had had our shows, we had raised over 100,000, you know. They took it to a whole new level and said that I had stolen that money that I had raised for charity. They took time to contact hotels and brands and threatened them. They went so far as to say they were physically boycotting hotels that I was going to stay in. You know, it is all wholly untrue, and I knew that I had to stand up for what was right and protect my name. Because that's all you have. That's all you have in life is your name.
Yes,
you're born with it. You die with it. My son has my name. My parents have my same name. And it has been maligned on social media.
Because,
you know,
the key to it is they're publishing it and broadcasting this to as big an audience as they can reach, and they're posting these.
I was worried. I said to Dad, "What if people start believing this, Dad?" I said, "What am I going to do? I can't stand up for myself. They're hiding behind anonymous accounts. If there's one closed down, they'll open up three more. I needed to claim back my own name. I needed to prove it to people that I wasn't this person that people, you know, with anonymous accounts were portraying me as." And I went to the highest court in the land to get it, you know, that landmark case that did happen, you know. They believed me.
And when Lisa was despairing of the situation, she turned to her dad.
Dad could see me. You know, I was coming on my social media channels every morning with a smile on my face, and people would know me because I'm always smiling and always laughing. But I was dealing with this in the background for months. And Dad, I was broken last year. I mean, I don't know will I ever be fixed, but I was broken last year. And I said to Dad, "What am I going to do? I can't have Dara seeing me crying. I can't, you know, I had gone in on myself. The bit of sleep that I was getting, I was losing weight." Dad said to me, I said, "What? Please help me, Dad. You always help me and it's always helped me." I said, "What am I going to do?" I said, "Lisa, they're only bullies." And he said, "What do you do with bullies? You unmask them." And I said, "Okay." He said, "You go to court," he said, "and wherever you get the money, and I'll help," he said, "and we'll get to the bottom of this," he said.
Great.
Yeah. And my dad, I have to say that was my dad. Yeah.
Yeah. So fair play. Oh, that's so lovely. Fair play to Brendan. And that was great advice. Stand up, take on the bullies. And that's what you did. And you had to go to the High Court, didn't you?
Mm-hmm.
Because, did you initially go to Facebook to ask, could they reveal who these anonymous trolls were?
I got a really, really good legal team. And with that then, well, the guards were involved, there was private investigators involved, there was barristers involved. I mean, there was huge cost. But at the end of the day, if you don't have your name, you have nothing. And my business, both as an online or my online presence and as an insurance broker, it's wholly based on trust. People trust me with their financial needs. At work here for the last 30 years, people trust me online with my recommendations. If people lost trust in me, what am I? I'm nothing. So no matter what it was going to cost me, I was clearing my name in the honest way, only way possible. And I was terrified. I was absolutely terrified. But I just said, enough is enough. I can't. It was escalating daily. It was getting worse and worse. And I said, you know, that's it. I've had enough. This has got to stop. And we did Facebook, where they were incredible. Facebook were incredible. They listened to the claims. They didn't charge their costs. They were shocked at the contents of the abuse. Anything that we looked for, they gave to my legal team.
And we should say that the legal issue here was that Facebook, they couldn't actually legally release the information that you wanted, could they?
No, they couldn't unless it was given by
so the High Court order was required.
Yeah.
That is what you won.
And that's what I won, and that's what I got. Yeah.
We can tell even today, even though, well, I was going to say you're out of it, but you're saying you're not sure if you'll be recovered just yet. But the toll this took on you, your followers didn't know about it. Can you tell us about that day when you won in the High Court?
Well, do you know what? It was a personal win for me, you know, because I knew this was all going on in the background. I didn't tell my followers what was going on. You know, I didn't tell my brands what were going on. Linda, who's a really, really good friend of mine, she was my rock throughout the whole thing. You know, I did a small, my parents, my son, my partner, we were doing it in the background, and they were saying, keep going, Lisa, keep going, Lisa, keep going. And then it was like, all of a sudden, this High Court ruling came out, and I went, you know, it's not just for me. I'm glad that I took them to court, but I mean, there's so many other people out there that maybe they just couldn't do what I did, whether emotionally or financially, do it for themselves. But I needed to raise awareness for, you know, the real people at the end of these nasty comments, how much it hurt and upsets people. I mean, I did it for me, and I did it for people who couldn't, I suppose. Yeah,
absolutely.
I had no choice. I had no choice but to take them on. Yeah. And I would do the same again tomorrow.
And your dad, Brendan, who told you to face what you do with bullies, you face up to them.
Mm-hmm.
And they duly collapsed away, didn't they?
They did, you know, within the minute I think it was the Irish Times or somebody published it first, and then I think a lot of the papers then got it. There were anonymous accounts closed down within minutes. But it was too late at that stage because we had got all the IT addresses. I mean, the legal team were there working in the background, taking screenshots. You know, I had a full team working in the background there. So the more that was written about me, the bigger the case was becoming, you know.
And Lisa now knows the names of some of the people who were sending her those messages.
Yes, I know who some of them are. It has. Look, it's been a very difficult time for me, you know. But I've got through it. It's 2021. It's underlined all the positives in my life. My parents, my son's support, my friends, my colleagues, especially Linda, you know. And then on the business side, I've got practical and emotional support from all the great Irish brands I work with. As I said, Facebook were incredible. My followers were a powerful, powerful support. A powerful support, yeah. It was a tiny percentage that caused me a hassle. And thank God my business is going really well now. And it's a truism that truth always comes out in the end. Always. Yeah.
I mean, we're all listening to this and we're thinking about those tiny bullies and we all want revenge on them. And you could sue them.
Yes, I could. I could, yeah. Yeah, I could.
Are you still thinking about it?
I can't. I'm limited in what I can say because it's with my legal team.
Yeah. Were you surprised? Did you know any of the people involved when you finally found out who they were?
I didn't know them personally. I had never met them. I had never conversed with them. So, no. These are not my friends, no.
Did they attempt to explain, or was there any?
I did. I got, through the course, I got apology letters. One of them went into 4 pages. Yes, I got apology letters. So this is what I can't understand, how somebody was trying to ruin me online, but once they were found out and once we had got a name, that they would write me a 3-page apology letter.
That's Lisa McGowan with Oliver Callan in the morning. And back to those break-in stories from the live line. This is Jane telling Joe about a double burglary at her family home.
So my mum passed away when I was 8. She had skin cancer, actually, so put on your sunscreen. It's very hot. But about 10 years ago, my dad's house got broken into. The place was turned upside down and all my mum's jewellery was missing. Now, this would be her engagement ring, you know, various bits and pieces that I would have remembered her wearing as a kid. So a lot of sentimental stuff.
Okay.
And then, you know, I was devastated, obviously. I'd searched everywhere for it. Really, really devastated. And then 10 years later, the same house, my dad's house, was broken into again. He didn't have the cop on to get an alarm in that 10 years. But the house got broken into again and, you know, I was long moved out of the house. So I went back and I helped him clean up. You know, he's there on his own and, you know, the place was upside down. So as I was, like, cleaning everything up, putting everything back in its drawers, I found my mum's old makeup bag filled with all of her jewellery that had obviously been pushed to a back of a wardrobe 10 years ago in the first burglary. And then resurfaced 10 years later. So it was kind of a happy silver lining story.
So the second burglary led you to do an even greater search of the house, and that's how you discovered your... By the way, was anyone ever caught for either burglary?
No, not at all. And, you know, it wasn't even that I did a search. The bag itself had been thrown onto my dad's bed. But I guess the burglars didn't realise that there was a lot of jewellery inside it. It was just the makeup bag that she used to own. No one was caught.
And I see you say, I don't know how you know this, but you said my teenage diaries were read by the burglars.
Yeah, well, actually, that was another time. I've been burgled a few times in my life. When I was about 21, I was living in a student house and I had loads of diaries and things, and everything had been ripped out. All my like 10 different diaries had been opened, and it's just very violating, you know. It's not even about what they took. I think they just took some Nike runners, actually. It's not like we had anything at that age. At 21, didn't have any money. But it's just that someone was in your space. It's not nice.
Well, that's Jane. Then Mark called with his bizarre story.
Joe, yeah, it was a long time ago, Joe. But I suppose they came into the house. I came home from work late that night, maybe about 2:30, 3:00 in the morning. I was driving a taxi at the time. And I got up the next morning and I opened up the back door and I realised it wasn't locked. And I said to myself, oh, that's strange. And then I realised that the barrel had been popped in the back door. So then I started to investigate, you know, obviously somebody had been in the house and what was missing. And I'd left some money in the kitchen drawer that I made the night before for my wife the next morning to go shopping. And obviously that was gone. Her wedding ring was gone. My daughter's mobile phone was taken. And I suppose the horrible thing was that they rang me the next day, that day, on my daughter's mobile phone and said to me, how are you doing? Do you know who this is? And I says, obviously, you know, you're the guy that has my daughter's mobile phone. Now, she was only a young child at the time. You know, I've got 15. And he goes, yeah, he says, you know, we were in your house last night. And I said, yeah, okay. And he says, what do you want? And he goes, I just want to let you know that I closed the door after me. So I said, oh, that's great. Thanks very much. And he says, did you get the key to your car? He says, I left in your ignition.
Right.
And I says, oh, that's very good of you.
Yeah.
And he says, so you've nothing to worry about. He says, you're full and plenty. And I said, do you think so?
You've what?
You've nothing to worry about. You're full and plenty.
You're full and plenty.
Yeah. Because of where we're living, Joe. You know,
you just saw that what they were doing. It's like the Fox Rock phenomenon we heard the other day. Ah, it's Fox Rock. Where did they get their money from? Nonsensical arguments.
Yeah.
They believe what they believe because you had earned
worked and earned money, they had a right to take some of it.
I don't know what was going through their minds, Joe, you know? I mean, who can ever work out what's going through the minds of a guy that actually rings you the next day? And he rang my mother as well. He went through my daughter's phone list and...
What did he say to your mother?
He just rang her. He says, how you doing? He says, we were in your granddaughter's house last night.
Good God.
My mother got a fright and she just hung up and then she rang me.
Yeah.
You know, she obviously knew, like, you know, that I was after telling her that morning that we're after being boggled.
But did your daughter's number come up when your nan's phone, her nan's phone?
It did, yeah, it would have come up. Obviously, it would have come up, yeah. But he identified himself.
And you
they
say,
robbed three houses on the road that night, Joe. They, you know, it was funny the things they, well, I won't say funny, maybe that's the wrong choice of words, but they opened the fridge and they took the young boy, you know, a bottle of orange that it was in the fridge for his school the next morning for his lunch. You know, they took that and they drank that and they had some sweets and stuff. They went across the house, across the road, and apparently they opened their fridge and they sat in the sitting room. The woman was in her, at the time, the woman was in the house on her own. She was in bed. And yet they sat down inside in our sitting room and they had something to eat and they had something to drink. And the next morning when the neighbours were out on the road, looking around the road, there was, you know, wrappers of sweets and yogurt pots on the road.
So in other words, they were totally at home in a house they'd burgled.
Yeah, yeah. Same style, Joe. They took a BMW then at the time on a neighbour, and he was very upset because his baby's buggy was in the boot, and he said that he didn't care so much about the car but he needed the buggy, you know.
Were they ever caught? Did you ever hear them again?
They rang a radio show about maybe 4 or 5 days later, a late night talk show.
Okay.
And they were boasting and bragging that they had been up in the area and that they'd robbed some houses in Selbridge and they'd robbed some houses in Clane, and, you know, they'd taken a BMW and they'd taken a Mini Cooper at the time.
Well, that's Mark. Then Tom called Joe. Tom has been burgled very recently.
On the 6th of July, Joe.
And what happened?
I leave very early every morning for work.
Okay, good.
Around 4, maybe shortly after us.
Wow.
And that particular morning, I was going out.
Yeah.
And I noticed I had a light left on in the kitchen, and I went back in to switch it out. I live at about 100 metres and off the road.
Okay.
And when there's a church down the road a little bit from me, when I was going down by the church, this car was stopped at the church. I thought it peculiar that there'd be someone there that hour in the morning, past no remarks. Well, I said, well, I go back, and I said, no, I have to be here and I have to be there, just to think. So when I came back that day, I was going for my second vaccine injection that day, and I came back at 12:30.
Right.
And my God, Joe, when I came in, the place was wrecked.
Ah. And what had they taken?
They had, I had a lot of old coin, two shillings and half crowns.
Okay.
An old gentleman died a few years ago and left it to me.
All right.
And that's what they brought. Now, they went to stoop so low, they even pulled the lagging jacket off the cylinder. They got up in the attic, they pulled the mattresses apart.
Yeah.
Drawers that would only come out so far, 3/4 ways, they brought them out the whole way.
They wrecked them, yeah.
You know, wrecked the place.
And there would...
My neighbour, yeah. I have a very good neighbour here, and I brought him in to see the... And the poor man, they nearly died with a heart attack.
The state of your
house. I have a few good buddies in the guards of Mullingar, and I rang them, and within a few minutes, they were out.
Yeah.
And they were very good.
And do you have any idea how many who broke into your house? How many?
I don't know. I said it could have been two, Joe.
Yeah,
it could have been watch out man in the car and the other guy came in.
It's obviously two, yeah.
Now, I have an alarm system which was put in 22 years ago, and thanks to God, I've upgraded it ever since. But they got in by that. They got in by that. Do you know?
And how did they use a screwdriver to break into
it? Oh, used a screwdriver, yeah. To try the back door first, and I had a pin in that couldn't be opened. So then they got in the front window. They smashed the front window and in they got. And they had plenty of time, because they obviously knew my movement. I wouldn't be back home until sometime in the afternoon each day, you know.
Oh, what, Tom, you're great getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning. What do you do?
A meat man.
Oh, good man, good man. Fair play to you now. How long have you been doing that?
Oh, just 36 years.
Ah, fantastic. Fantastic. How many days a week are you doing it now?
Well, the hours I work about 8 days, but 6 we work. 6
You do 6 days?
Yeah, 6 days.
At 4 o'clock in the morning?
Yeah, Monday to Saturday.
And you work for yourself, so to speak?
Yeah, I work for myself, yeah. I work with John B.
Yeah, you deliver for them, yeah. 36 years up at 4 o'clock every morning, 6 days a week.
Yeah.
That must be a record.
I don't know, but that's it.
And what time do you go to bed at?
Oh, I need very little rocking now, Joe, when I lay down. Yeah. Well, during the soccer time, it was 10 o'clock, I was breaking all rules. I usually go around 9 or half 9, you know.
Okay, good man.
I don't need any rocking. When I lay down, lights out.
You don't need anyone to rock you to sleep.
No. I don't need anyone to rock me to sleep. No.
Tom, why did they tear the lagging jacket off your immersion?
Because that obviously thought there was money in it. Ah. They thought there was money hidden somewhere, Joe.
And would they have known you were a milkman?
Would have, yeah. I had a briefcase that a friend of mine gave me for Christmas one time back a few years ago. And the only time I'd use it would be at Christmas time. I'd put the Christmas tree up and raise it up a bit in the room. And that was actually, they actually tore that apart. Thinking there was money in it. Yeah.
And
it's an awful sensation to know that somebody has been in the house, you know.
And how were you after that then?
The guys in Mullingar were very good. And there was a lady, a crime prevention officer, they wrote to me and different things. You'd be a bit nervous, Joe.
No. I'm just thinking of the service you've given people for 36 years. Is it in and around Mullingar, Tom?
Yeah, we do about 14-mile radius of Mullingar, yeah.
And did you ever come across, given that you're out here, did you ever come across other houses being burgled?
No, I never come across. I come across different things, Joe, but never houses being burgled, no. No.
You see, you probably know why. Your routine is so strong that burglars would know, well, there's no point going up that road because Tom will be, the milkman comes down.
Yeah.
And
different things, but never, no, the odd time, it must have been 20 years ago, yes. Yeah. We were out the country one morning and I noticed the van in the street and I rang the boys in Mullingar and within a few minutes there was somebody out to him, yeah, and they nabbed them that morning. That must be, that's 20 years ago, yeah.
So 6 days a week, 36 years. Do you get a holiday? You must get a holiday.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, good man. Yeah. Okay. And by the way, so to come back to the burglary, which happened 3 or 4 weeks ago, you reckon they used a screwdriver?
2 weeks ago yesterday.
2 weeks,
oh,
2 weeks.
I never forget.
Okay, well, that's a very, very fair point. Two weeks ago yesterday, 6th of July, you'll never forget it. But what did you, given that screwdriver was used in your case, what do you think of the screwdriver up on the altar?
It's ridiculous. I'm very surprised that the present Archbishop hasn't said something about that, you know.
Hmm. Well, the previous Archbishop has made it.
He has, yeah.
But the current Archbishop says...
The man that's there now is the Mullingar man.
Oh, is he, yeah?
Yeah.
And did he ever speak out about crime in Mullingar, if there was any crime?
No, not at that particular stage. No, he was a very nice man when he was there.
Yeah, I'm sure
he
is. A very well-educated man.
Well, that's Tom on the live line with Joe Duffy. And that's it for Playback Daily, so mind yourself till next time.